Welcome to Arrows on Air, presented by Tomorrow's Air. I'm Christina Beckman, and this is a show about the other sides of climate action. Here we learn from the fascinating experiences of adventurers, artists, storytellers, and scientists who help show us not only the how of climate action, but also why it's worth the effort. Hello and welcome. I'm really excited about this episode because it coincides with a new partnership here at Tomorrow's Air. We've recently signed a supplier agreement with Octavia Carbon, the first direct air capture provider coming out of the global south. In this conversation, I'm very honored and inspired to have the chance to talk with Fiona Mungabi and Martin Freimuller, who are building the machines in Fiona's case and leading the company in Martin's case. Fiona led the design and testing of Octavia's Gen 1 machines, optimizing their efficiency and ensuring operational excellence. Her background is in electrical engineering from the University of Nairobi, and this positions her to bridge the gap between technology and policy for a sustainable future. Martin is the founder of Octavia Carbon and has a background in management consulting after receiving his formal education at Cambridge, where he was first in his class, with a focus on social and political science. This conversation kicks right off with some of the hard stuff, diving right into the technical nature of direct air capture and what's special about building a direct air capture plant in Kenya. This is one of the more technical conversations you'll find at Arrows on Air, but if you're interested in how direct air capture carbon removal technology is evolving, this one is definitely for you. We talk about the differentiating aspects of operating in Kenya, namely access to geothermal energy and ready storage and ample capacity in geologic formations. We discuss monitoring, reporting and verifications of these technologies, the presence of third-party auditors, and how scandals from the conventional offsetting markets have influenced the new generation of carbon removal innovators in measuring the emissions they generate and remove. We also explore the intersection of tourism and climate tech, and how now Kenya is beginning to be known for climate action alongside its incredible biodiversity and human cultural history. We talk about the leadership of Kenyan people in the team powering Octavia. I was especially charmed by Fiona's description of seeing the first designs for their direct air capture plant come to life. And when I asked if she was a tinkerer as a younger woman, her infectious laugh and description of her childhood and formative education with a focus in math and physics totally got me. We also learn about Martin's background as an Austrian who spent a couple years of his youth in South Africa and Zambia before going on to study at Cambridge and focus on international development. He shares his perspective as a techno-optimist and how the name for Octavia as a company came to him even before he knew it would be a direct air capture company. It was researching carbon removal opportunities in the global south for a consulting project that led him to see the potential of Kenya as an ideal place to build direct air capture plants. I really hope you enjoy this conversation. Okay, Martin and Fiona, I'm so happy to have both of you on the line. I think as we were talking before, we'll first kind of chat with you both about Octavia and direct air capture and what makes Kenya special for this kind of carbon removal, and then do a little sort of focused, friendly interrogation of each of you, because I'm so curious about your backgrounds and how you came to this great, great company, great job that you're working. But first, let's just talk about direct air capture. Octavia Carbon is the first direct air capture company coming out of the global south. Tell us a little bit about first just what is direct air capture for people who aren't familiar with it.
Thank you, Christina, for having us. So direct air capture, this is simply technology that actually removes CO2 from the atmosphere. And how it works, it's a two-stage process where you have a capture phase and a release phase. In the capture phase, air comes into contact with a chemical filter. The chemical filter then selectively traps the CO2. Then now you move to the release phase, now where the chemical filter is isolated. Then once it's isolated, it's energized. And at that point, the CO2 is regenerated. Once it's regenerated, this can be channeled either for permanent storage or utilization.
And the filter material, I think this is where I have, this is where it seems like a lot of the magic happens for, and a lot of the differentiation between different kinds of direct air capture approaches. And what's special or the same about how Octavia is producing this filter?
Thank you. So full disclosure, I'm not, my background is not in chemical engineering. My background is in electrical and electronics engineering, but basically how it works. So our chemical filter is an amine-based chemical filter. And this is solid sorbent. This is what we use. And for how it works, or basically just we prepare the chemical filter ourselves. This is silica and PEI. And then once you prepare this chemical filter from raw materials, from Nordby's production, or just basically how it works, I can just give you an analogy of a sponge. You can think about, you know, a sponge which has not been, you know, inserted in water. So once the sponge is exposed to the atmosphere, now you can think about this sponge being, you know, inserted in water. And then once you energize the chemical filter, it's a similar thing of actually squeezing this sponge. And that's at which point now the CO2 is regenerated. So for us, what differentiates us or our chemical filter, we design it such that it can leverage, we can heat this chemical filter with, you know, with the geothermal steam. And this is one of the things, why this is what makes Kenya the best place for direct air capture, because, you know, we have the energy, we have the geology, and we have the talent. So in terms of energy, we have that kind of geothermal capacity to actually scale the manufacturing and actually full-scale manufacturing of direct air capture.
Yeah, and I think what might be worth mentioning there is that a lot of attention is rightly given to the chemistry in direct air capture, but the truth is that direct air capture is a hard problem. Again, fundamentally, like thermodynamically, what you're trying to do is to take a compound that's at 0.04% of atmospheric concentrations, again, that's CO2 in air, and you try to like concentrate it to like quite high concentrations suitable for CO2 storage, and that is hard. And the chemistry is like a big part of that, but there's like dozens and dozens of way less sexy engineering problems that you have to work through, basically. Everything from, you know, like, you know, moving heat, moving mass, moving gases, and then like recovering energy throughout that process. And I think that is also why we have a quite large engineering team, and we have, for example, engineers who just think about how heat moves through that system. And a lot of our sort of IP is from integration with geothermal that Fiona mentioned. So yes, that has implications on the choice of chemistry that we use, which regenerates at a uniquely low temperature, allowing us to use a very broad array of geothermal heat. But then it's also like really relevant for like the broader process engineering, the way we integrate with geothermal quite closely to use a variety of geothermal fluids as the sort of ready and highly concentrated and very cost-effective form of energy to really take our direct air capture to very large scale.
What has been explained to me at one point is that amine-based removal takes more energy. So that's sort of one of the disadvantages. And because your unique location in Kenya, this is not a problem for you. Am I summarizing that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I think generally, like, you right, because the tricky thing about amines is that they don't generally like hang out by themselves. They like to sort of sit on top of a support material. And the tricky thing is then if you like regenerate your sorbent with heat, you have to heat the support material as well as the CO2 capture agent itself, which then leads to some sort of parasitic heat losses, as it would be called. And the thing that is really valuable there, and I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, like that is true, but then again, like there's no such thing as 100% efficient air capture system. And even thermodynamically, the minimum work that it takes to concentrate CO2 from atmospheric concentrations is about 128 kilowatt hours of electricity. Well, not electricity, like energy. I've just sort of given away a key differentiator here, which is that it matters a lot where that energy comes from. Because again, DAC is again, inherently thermodynamically energy intensive. And if you can use low grade heat for the bulk, and for us, it's like more than 80% of that energy, that allows you to bring that air capture way down the cost curve. Because, you know, geothermal heat in Kenya is very cheap. You can literally get it for about a dollar cent per kilowatt hour. And that allows you to like actually take the cost of direct air capture way down. There will still be a lot of optimization that you can do on, like, actually reducing the energy that you need to put into the system. And partly that's something I mentioned earlier about, like, how you recover energy that flows throughout that system and from your gas stream, etc. But a lot of the problem here is really fundamental to the technology. Again, direct air capture in many ways is trading off renewable energy against carbon removal. And that is a problem if you live in a place where renewable energy is a constraint, and that is frankly most places on Earth. But Kenya is not such a place. It has both a like more than 90% renewable grid, lots of geothermal, lots of hydro, but importantly, like it has oodles of geothermal heat. You can literally drive along the East African Rift Valley and on a cold morning and see geothermal plumes come from the ground again. And that is energy, that's renewable energy from the Earth's core that is uniquely abundant in the East African Rift Valley, which is also like which built the conviction me to move my life to Kenya a few years ago to actually like design to build a direct air capture company here, because again there's fundamentals that you can't get around easily with direct air capture, and essentially like it depends a lot on like your creative ways of solving that. And it matters that Kenya is now building out that geothermal capacity. Like most places on Earth, especially in rich countries, geothermal has been at sort of peak capacity, if not declining capacity, for decades. Whereas Kenya quadrupled its geothermal capacity to close to gigawatt of installed power. And also, like, that's about seventh largest producer of geothermal now. And get this, Kenya wants to quadruple its geothermal deployment again over the next decade. And that means that it will be the world's largest geothermal producer, having this unique endowment with the Rift Valley. So that's partly what excites us a lot, because we can integrate quite deeply with geothermal processes from scratch. And that's also where a lot of our IP comes from, because it's inherently a lot easier to drive that integration from the start than to try to retrofit.
And just maybe to just add on to that, I mean, you know, Kenya is also very special because, you know, for us, we're not supply constrained. For us, we actually just need this. We need more manufacturing facilities here so that we can actually put more of these geothermal wells online. And by doing so, you know, there's just that unique benefit to like the Kenyans themselves. I mean, you know, you'll be able to actually not just cross-subsidizing the cost of electricity, but also just, you know, increasing energy access for millions of Kenyans.
Hmm. Well, I definitely want to talk more about Kenya. But before we go to that, when we started Tomorrow's Air, I think there were three direct air capture carbon removal suppliers: Global Thermostat, Carbon Engineering, and Climeworks. And now, you know, there's a map with direct air capture happening all around the world, which is so exciting. And I read someplace, I can't remember where, that there are maybe 18 of these that are operational. Project Hummingbird is Octavia Carbon's direct air capture. Is that considered operational as yet, or nearly operational? Operational later this year. Say more about how you fit into that scheme. I mean, what an exciting thing to be, you know, one of so few so early in this new epoch.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, you know, for all that there is a map of tech companies at this point, one thing that constrains all of us is the availability of CO2 storage. Capture CO2, but where do we put it? Mm-hmm. And that is something that is very unique about Kenya, because we will be the world's second place after Iceland to have like a geological sequestration site. That is permitted, that is being developed by our partners at Sella Mineral Storage. And crucially, that is a key enabler for us to actually have a plant online way before anyone else. Again, by the end of this year, we expect to be the second to ever put CO2 underground as a DAC company after Climeworks. And that puts us in a unique position. And of course, it is exciting that we're doing this in Kenya and as the first in the Global South. But then it then also allows us to sort of mature technology a lot quicker than anyone else, and also like to use that to bring DAC down the cost curve. So at the moment, there's nothing on that site quite yet because the storage isn't yet ready. But we have a sort of demonstration plant running inside a facility producing CO2. And the idea is basically that from Q3 or so, we'll actually start transferring that mini plant to the sites. We'll have sort of a small phase one of Project Hummingbird initially online this year, about 250 tons per year and CO2 captured. And then we'll take that to scale very quickly after that. But yeah, it's exciting times. We'll literally go to the site tomorrow with our geothermal partner and with our storage partner, and then actually like do a lot of the actual planning on okay, what goes where and so on. So like we're very much sort of in the nuts and bolts of building that plant now. And that's like a quite unique position to be in as a DAC company, and a really exciting one to be in as well. It's really like rubber hits the road when you actually want to take CO2 out of the air and put it on the ground. And for all the talk there's been about the air capture, not enough of that has happened yet. So we're quite proud to sort of put our words in action there as well.
And were you, I think you came out of a, or you were partially funded by an accelerator. Is that, do I have that right? The Catalyst Fund. So that, you know, how much, I don't know if you can even say this, but how much money does it cost to build? And as I understand, Octavia is, has these small modular machines that you are manufacturing. How much, how many of those do you need to make? How much does this cost? How much money do you need?
It's a great question. And the answer that we're quite proud of is that a lot less than it took the first company to do so. Like, so like sort of the headline playing out here in my head before when we come online will be something like world's second air capture and storage project comes online on less than 1% of the funding first. And, you know, like it is a point of pride here because essentially to date, we've sort of invested about $2 million in investing our own, like in like you know, creating our own technology from scratch. And like to give you a sense of what that looks like, we literally get sheets of steel and sort of some basic industrial chemicals. And from that, basically make our own special source of their data capture technology. And that is like, you know, well over like, you know, 100,000 R&D hours that have gone into that process up to this point. And frankly, we can do this because we can just give engineers a very decent lifestyle at a fraction of the cost of most of our peers, especially, you know, ones based in sort of the dark air capture hotspots today, which is, you know, Zurich, Vancouver, San Francisco, those aren't cheap places to manufacture machines. And yeah, that is a point of pride for us. So we're sort of like, you know, we're investing an additional few million dollars into this initial plant. But it will be sort of very cost effective from the start, which is also, I think, important to combat another sort of, you know, popular misconception about their data capture, which is that it is inherently expensive, you know, expensive to build, expensive to develop, and just like, you know, expensive like from start to finish. It doesn't have to. Again, I think there's real sort of like value in thinking creatively about like how can we optimize the sort of supply chain and really do this in the best places on earth to do this, and how can that bring things down the cost curve. And as we've seen from wave after wave of climate tech, whether it's solar or batteries or EVs or wind, you really need Global South innovation and ingenuity and talent to bring new tech down the cost curve and do so in a time frame that is actually like climate relevant. So for us, that target is to bring DAC to sort of well below sort of $150 per ton by 2030. And like the ambition is to do so, to bring it below $100 per ton by that time. That is sort of a big burden of proof that we now actually have to show, but fundamentally we can, you know, both leverage a sort of low-cost manufacturing base, giving people a decent lifestyle for a fraction of the cost, but then also using like the unique resources that Kenya offers in terms of geothermal and geology to also like really eliminate the sort of penalizing energy part of the cost equation for that data capture. And yeah, that makes us excited to really like bring that down the cost curve pretty aggressively. And to, you know, even today be like a cost leader, it matters to bring that down the cost curve because it really has the potential to mitigate hard to abate emissions at scale and beyond that, clean up the atmosphere. So we're quite excited about that.
I had a coffee with a old friend the other day. He's a finance guy, works for a venture capital firm, and he sort of leaned back in his chair and he was like, oh, Christina, direct air capture will never scale. They say they're going to get to $100 a ton, but there's no chance. And then he, you know, sort of rattled off this litany of reasons why. And I sort of felt like in that moment, but what is like, what are the talking points for that? When that happens again, and the guy across the table says, oh, it'll never scale. Where do I point them, or what do I say?
Yeah, let me tell you what to say, which is that, thermodynamically, it's hard. But the idea that you can capture CO2 from something as dilute as the atmosphere is about as crazy as thinking you can capture energy from something as dilute as sunlight, right? We've done it before. Again, stuff isn't always thermodynamically easy, but humanity has generally found ways of, beating thermodynamics and actually beating the odds in that sense. So this is a hard engineering challenge that has absolutely, there's no way of denying that. Much like, again, like getting electricity from sunlight is always going to be harder than just burning a lump of coal, right? But that doesn't mean it's not possible, right? Like a lot of it comes down to how can you sort of really optimize engineering and the natural resources that you have to invest in that process to make it scale. And I think, frankly, every, novel climate technology, was dismissed a long time because, that's part of the tricky thing that we're in the business of doing, right? Because there is established alternatives. Well, in the case of the air capture, the alternative is, doing nothing. But, right, if you have used combustion cars for, a century, then yeah, of course, it's going to sound like ridiculous to think that you can use electricity to power a car, because how are batteries ever going to get to that energy density to move a car around? Again, thermodynamically, it's not easy. And again, time and time again, we've just proven that humanity, can't quite beat thermodynamics, but can leverage it in our favor. So that's the sort of answer I would give to that, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I lean towards the notion that there are inventions and innovations and ideas that, that can help us. And we have to be open to those things. And just because you can't fathom it today doesn't mean that it won't be possible tomorrow. And throughout all kinds of history, you can trace, the naysayers who get proven wrong. And I also think it's essential to the effort in climate that we remain optimistic and that we support these efforts. The ability to move, up the learning curve and down the cost curve comes from putting the effort in. And, it's very easy to sit on the sidelines and say it'll never work, but I do think it's worth trying. And I love that there are good reasons to believe it's possible. And you have lots of smart backers behind you.
I was going to say, the thing that always shocks me there is that, if you think about, ways of addressing climate change, we just need technology. And I think the best illustration of that is the pandemic, right? Like 2020, all of us sat at home, no cars on the road, no airplanes in the sky. And you know how much CO2 emissions went down that whole year? 7%, right? The point is, we have to remove emissions, we have to reduce emissions by 100%. And that's going to be really hard. And we need technology. And a lot of that technology does not exist today. And so we really need to focus on ways of creating that technology and iterating and competing and collaborating in turn to really just make sure we, let technology sort of do its thing and actually provide the solutions that we need, because just sort of trying to cut back is not going to cut it, because we can't just reduce, we can't just cut back. We need to get to zero. And for that, we need negative emissions technologies like direct air capture, as well as a whole range of other technologies. And, when you have the chance to abate an emission, you should always do so. But it's clearly, it's quite clear that it's not always that easy to do so.
I think you're also in the process of getting this certification or validation from Puro.earth.
So I think it just basically means that we have the highest quality carbon removal. And essentially, Pura is a fantastic team based out of Finland. They've been around for a while and have developed sort of best-in-class methodologies for removing CO2 from the atmosphere. And essentially, like, the goal there is to really remove the necessity of trust between a buyer and a supplier. By having a sort of trusted intermediary that has all sorts of certification, in the case of Pura, one crucial one they have is ICRA, which is the International Carbon Removal and Offsetting Alliance. I hope I got that right. And essentially to say, okay, like, there is a protocol that we follow. It's audited by a sort of credible, fourth party auditor. And essentially in that equation, you can sort of trust that that carbon removal was actually delivered. And, we're proud that, as far as we know, we'll be the first one to issue credits under the Pura standard, which also means that our direct air capture credits will be the first to be ICRA, be issued under an ICRA endorsed methodology. So that's kind of how we think about that. Pura has a really great team, and essentially, like, by working with them, we are essentially able to sort of guarantee our buyers that what they are buying is, like, ultra reliable and very closely audited as well. And what I might say on top of that is that we've also recently announced a partnership with Carbon Future, the largest carbon removal marketplace. Again, fantastic team. And we are essentially launching a sort of MRV Plus product with them, again, as a first indirect air capture, where we will literally work with them to have third-party reporting of CO2 molecules running down our pipes. So the idea is that you will be able to go on the Carbon Future website and then look at grams of CO2 in a live ticker, gradually counting up, that get removed live in our process. And that is a level of fidelity that DAC can uniquely reach, that I think we really want to just pilot and show what's possible in carbon removal, because we really think that if this is going to be a industry that's, like, commoditized at the level of billions of tons that we remove every year, and that's enormous. That's, again, that's, like, one of the largest sort of weights of stuff that we move, like, in any industry in the world today, then we really just have to find ways of making it, like, ultra reliable and fungible, so to use a sort of technical term. Like, a ton has to be a ton has to be a ton. And I think for that it's really important that a ton isn't, like, a ton plus minus 20% thereabouts. It is, like, a ton to the gram. If I buy a kilogram of gold, I don't expect it to be, like, plus minus percent a kilogram. It's a kilogram. And I think that's essentially the level that we want to get to with the capture as well.
Well, I think it helps a lot to have the endorsement of those credible auditors. Does this mean, like, the Pura team comes to Kenya and wears a white suit and pokes around and carries a clipboard and says, I agree. How does that, what does that look like?
Nah, they get others to do that. No, essentially, like, they work with third-party auditors, there's the likes of, DNV, Eco Engineers, 350 Solutions, mm-hmm. that's, like, some prominent ones, mm-hmm. And they are sort of mm-hmm. specialized auditing services, like, in carbon removal and often other industries as well, that, have just, like a lot of trust to do this well. So, like, they will essentially, like, pick up a checklist from Pura, and then they'll go, like, through, like, have this size the vault correctly, do they have the right data on, like, leak detection and so on, like, in this, like, a long checklist, or things that, yes, there will be people on the ground poking around, asking very pedantic questions, but that is really, like, the level, the way that we generate trust in the system.
It's interesting because we don't have the frameworks yet for carbon removal that conventional carbon offsets have had, the VERA, the gold standard, those sort of regulating systems are not fully in place for all the different mechanisms of carbon removal. And so you're kind of at the ground floor of forming that system.
Yeah, no, we are. And I think it's on some level hard, because it puts a lot of onus on us as a sort of supplier to just, you know, really like push the level of quality that we're able to provide. Because I think it is inherently important that we sort of use this wave of carbon removal and sort of emerging net like negative emissions technologies to just show that we can do carbon markets better than the way they've been before. Again, I think the previous, you know, like conventional carbon market has done a lot of great work, but as sort of like scandals over the past years have made quite clear is that, like, I think they've also created a lot of like wrong incentives. And so we think that the best antidote to that is do away with the models, have sensors that actually read molecules of CO2 running down pipes. And yes, that is expensive today, but it doesn't have to be. And that's the really key thing about direct air capture. Like, it can give you that level of fidelity that we need to actually get to net zero. Because, you know, the thing people don't realize about net zero, it's hard. Like, tell me right now how many emissions you have to the kilogram, and I will give you a trophy. And the tricky thing there is that, like, you know, we need to get much better at actually understanding what net zero means. We need to understand how many emissions do we have exactly. And then also, like, how much CO2 do we remove exactly, right? And it's like, because models, you know, like, on some level we'll need them, but the tricky thing there is that we really need to be a lot more serious about tackling climate change and getting to net zero, because it matters. It matters a lot for the future of our children and for just being able to actually say what like net zero means and holding people accountable. And I think like direct air capture gives you sort of a level of like fidelity to enable that accountability, right? Because there's no more excuse about like, yeah, no, we just tried to do the best thing possible and bought a carbon credit for like, you know, $1 per ton or something like that. But increasingly it should just be like, you know, very high fidelity carbon removal looks a certain way and feels a certain way. And that is something that direct air capture can do. And that's something we're quite excited to be in the earliest days of scaling. And I think, you know, while it is like a burden to like really push quality in everything that you do all the time, it's also like a good differentiator for us. And I think it is a way to sort of like, you know, fix in people's minds from the very start that Kenyan direct air capture will have an obsession with quality. Kind of the way that, like, you know, Japanese bullet trains have an obsession with quality. Like, that's the sort of level of fidelity that we want to strive for.
I mean, you know, when you're talking about quality, talking about fairness, I mean, what just happened in the previous carbon markets, I think Kenya is really doing its most, you know, with the recently released draft regulations, carbon market regulations. It just shows, you know, they want this, that concerted effort to just ensure that, you know, there's growth in the carbon market system, and Kenya is going to continue being, you know, being a leader in Africa.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good kind of segue into Kenya. Of course, coming from, I mean, Tomorrow's Air is bringing travel businesses and travelers together to support the scale up of carbon removal technologies and climate education. We, you know, our audience is very familiar with Kenya from a touristic sense. And I think this, you know, I was just in the Masai Mara, like, a year and a half ago. Anyway, yeah, but this is like a whole new lens on this place, right? So it's like we think of it as a place for beautiful animal viewing and these, I don't know, the vast sort of the Serengeti, the sunsets, the plains. It's, I have a vision of it that is now like really shifting around this industry of carbon removal. Tell me what, I mean, do you think about that? Like, it must be the most gorgeous landscape to be doing this work.
Yeah, the Rift Valley is just beautiful. It really is. And, you know, here's an interesting fact. So, like, I can't disclose exactly where the location of the pilot plant will be yet, but it is a beautiful part of the Rift Valley. Not very densely inhabited where we'll deploy, but, you know, not too far from the sort of tourist trail. So the hope is that this can itself become a sort of showcase for what's possible in Kenya, right? And yeah, you will have those same beautiful landscapes and the animals, and then also like the, you know, world's second direct air capture and storage plant. And hopefully like that really, you know, inspires people to, you know, like think of these as sort of one system, right? Because ultimately, you know, we do this to conserve those landscapes. We do this to like protect those animals, because that is part of the natural heritage of Kenya that, you know, I think Kenya almost like uniquely well amongst global south countries has been an environmental steward over the past decades. You know, like one of the most famous Kenyans, Peace Nobel laureate Wangari Maathai, literally put her life on the line to protect like some of the forests of Nairobi and then like some of the natural landscapes of Kenya beyond that. And I think that is a story that every Kenyan school child learns and like is inspired by. And that is ultimately also what like inspires us to sort of take that environmental stewardship to that next technological level. And I think it'll be quite nice and inspiring to see those sort of integrate quite smoothly with each other. And also like that, you know, like natural form of geothermal energy that Kenya is uniquely endowed with, also powering like humanity's global effort to get to net zero. There's a lot of like lots that's inspiring about that.
It also feels like this this effort is very like Kenyan led. I mean, Martin, I know you're not from Kenya, but the Octavia team and the Kenyan government, I mean, this is not, or maybe I'm wrong, is this another sort of colonial effort where people from other places come in and develop an industry? Or do we have a different situation where it's Kenyans developing an industry?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. So for us, I mean, we are, you know, we are approximately 58, and, you know, apart from Martin, we'll be 57. but what's really important to see here is that, you know, we design and build this machine. So it's tech which has been designed by Kenyans, tech which is being deployed by Kenyans. So even when you go to the communities can actually relate to us. You can actually, you know, describe the technology, you know, in Swahili and talk to them and tell them this is actually how the technology works. So this is tech designed by Kenyans. You know, and it's not, you know, the, you know, neocolonialism, or it's more of we see the, you know, the urgency to actually build up this tech. We see what it's doing, you know, to our climate. We see, you know, the differences, what it has been when we were like, you know, going to, you know, our primary school to now, right now, just cleared university. We see the vast differences in our climates, and because of that, we are motivated every day. We have that sense of, you know, agency to actually build out this tech that's actually going to, you know, provide a habitable planet for our children. And it's something that is really motivating for, you know, each and every one of us. And I think, you know, during the community engagements we usually do, I remember, you know, there's this one girl who just asked me, you mean you actually designed and built these machines yourselves? And, you know, it just, they see that, you know, actually we can actually be originators of deep tech as well. And, you know, it's something that also just inspires even, you know, for example, the girls to get into more STEM programs or more engineering programs to actually, you know, build out, you know, this industry, which is going to be very much needed in the near future.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, go ahead, Christina.
Please, Martin, you go ahead.
No, thank you. I mean, you know, we take pride in being a 98% Kenyan company. So, like, other than me, like, everyone is Kenyan. And, you know, like, Kenya, like, again, deliberately benefits from being a crossroads for the world. Nairobi is a very cosmopolitan city with people bringing ideas from everywhere. And again, we know from the way that other places develop that can be a big value add. And, you know, like not everyone has the same ability to take risks and start like, you know, new businesses and like pursue new ideas. But being that crossroads, I think as long as it's coupled with like really strong local leadership, really has the means of just like, you know, enabling the sort of knowledge transfer and growth that can actually lead to the emergence of like new industries in Kenya. And I think Kenya takes pride in having done that across multiple waves. Again, like, you know, M-Pesa, which some folks might know, like it's like the sort of mobile money, like, you know, sending money through your smartphone or like your phone, even just more broadly than that, is something that has, you know, like followed a similar like trajectory, right? That like, you know, was sort of like, you know, led and spearheaded by like a partnership of like, you know, international thought leaders and local talent, and has like really scaled massively in Kenya and way beyond that to almost every place of the global south now uses mobile money. That idea originated in about 2007 in Kenya, and again I think it's just really something that we want to catch on more broadly as well. So like it's usually like being a crossroads is something that Kenya deliberately encourages and benefits from, and I think has shown in the past can actually work.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, there's so much technological advancements in the country compared with the rest of the continent. We are actually known as a Silicon Savannah. So you know, we have just that kind of, you know, tech talent in the country.
Fiona, you, I think, led the design and testing of Octavia's first generation machines. What, you know, you're not new to this game. What is that like? But how are you, do you feel like this is your baby?
I mean, yeah, so I mean, when you have an opportunity to come back to Kenya, please pass by our manufacturing facilities, you'll see, our last born, or, you know, our baby, that's one of our one-ton machine, our prototype, we call it Thursday, because we launched it on a Thursday, so, you know, just don't let your engineers name your machines for you. But let me just give you some context of how I actually got into that role of what was happening. So that was in September 2022. You know, I just got a call from Duncan, and, you know, it was like, hey, Fiona, can you please come? We want to power this machine. And, you know, at that point, I had no idea about direct air capture. So, you know, it was a pretty confusing thing. And, you know, right now, if you search direct air capture, there's a whole world of knowledge that you'll find, and it will be very hard for you to debunk with me, you know, at night. But then I said, you know what, yeah, I'll come the next day. And the important thing to note, with direct air capture, it's a fundamental engineering problem. It's just, you know, engineering principles which have just been, you know, broken down. So I think the process of, you know, designing and building the first, you know, electrical systems, the, you know, power control and automation systems for our first prototype machine was exhilarating. I remember when we were, you know, in the apartment one day, and I don't know if you remember when we actually just switched on, pressed the on button for the machine, and then it just roared, and it was such an exciting time to actually see new designs come to life. And, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, really actually motivates the people, the guys we work with, our colleagues, to actually, you know, move from, you know, a CAD model, you know, from a simulation to actually building it out and actually seeing your designs come to life. And, you know, it's not just designs that come to life, but designs which have a positive impact in our future. So it's just been exhilarating. Yeah.
Were you like a tinkerer as a young woman? Have you always been oriented this way?
Oh, yeah, quite interesting. I remember, I think I broke my dad's camera just trying to understand how it works. Said they could not put it back together. But, you know, one of those small projects you have when you're a teenager. One, things like that just lead you into doing engineering. I think mostly, especially in my high school days, I loved maths and physics. Anytime you'd find me just reading maths and physics and nothing else, I think there was a huge problem where, you know, it was very hard for me to really relate with other concepts apart from this. Yeah, but yeah, I was a tinker at a young age. I broke a few devices at my dad's. but yeah, I think right now, I think I actually need to get him a new camera. Yeah.
So I never did anything like that, I will confess. It was not, I was writing stories and drawing pictures. Do you have brothers and sisters? What does your family think?
I have a brother and a sister. My brother is 14 years old. My sister is, she's 25 years old. So I think they're both pretty proud of the work I do here at Octavia, not just them, but my whole family. I think for them it's very new. You know, they're used to, you know, seeing people going to this, you know, orthodox roles, you know, just, you know, normal white people jobs. And then there's me, Fiona, working in direct air capture, a very new concept. And I think for them, they just, every time we have an opportunity, they're like, oh, so what are you working on right now? Have you built a new machine? Where's the CO2 right now? You know, are you expanding? And every time I think the last time my sister, you know, came to just, you know, see where I work, she was like, oh my God, you already have another facility. Like, how fast do you grow? I mean, and, you know, just for context, last year, at time like this, Martin, I think we were 11. And now, you know, we are more than five times right now. And, you know, it just showed, they just, their mind is just blown that, you know, the rate in which we grow. And I think for them, they just can't wait for the next thing to, what, you know, what's next for Octavia.
It's so interesting. And I think I read that you also, I was poking around like a spy in your LinkedIn, and I saw you posted about going to the COP. What was that like to be at that global conference and representing not only your company, but in a way, the whole country? What was that like? I've never been to the COP, by the way.
No, I mean, we were humbled, I think, as Octavia, getting that accreditation from, you know, the government and, you know, just them allowing us to actually represent, you know, the, director capture from the country at COP. And, you know, it being my first COP, I think I was humbled by the experience.
And the final thing I just want to poke at a little bit is, Fiona, what's it like being a woman? Is this like all men? I have a notion of of a direct air capture plant as very male. And I don't know why I think that, but is it that? Maybe it's not even that. Maybe it's a bunch of chicks.
We are approximately 35% females here at Octavia, and we want to push this to 50-50, by the end of year, that's a goal we have. But also, you know, we're also quite conversant with, you know, how the nature here in the country, you know, where you have more, the engineering side is more male-dominated than females, but be that as it may, we want to break that form of barrier here at Octavia. And I think, you know, as a woman in Octavia, I think, Octavia has really supported us, has supported, women in technology, especially, and just giving us the right tools we need, you know, to prosper, we need to actually get things done. And I think, yeah, it's very hard because, you know, there's no form of distinction, you know, to say, oh, you know, this she's female or this male. I think because we are all putting our heads, to work, so there's no form of discrimination in that aspect. And Octavia is just a great place for everyone to work. And I think that's one feedback we usually get, especially when you do, our monthly sessions, just catching up, finding out, you know, how best can we support each other, especially, you know, the women in tech, and how do we actually bring in more people here. So, I mean, being actually the first, female engineer here at Octavia, it's been an impressive ride for me. And I've seen similar colleagues, female colleagues, just, you know, really get the most out of Octavia because of this. And this is something I'm super grateful for.
You're so, and then I'm going to interrogate Martin, but Fiona, you're so articulate and composed, and yet you are very young. Is this kind of your first job? I think you just graduated recently. Like, this is bananas to me. What is this like? When I was your age, I am assuming your age based on when you graduated, but in my 20s, I was just such a spaz. I was waiting tables. Like, you are tackling the world's most pressing problem and building world-changing machines. It's so incredible. I just can't wrap my head around it.
I think it all comes to, like, you know, once you join, I mean, let me not lie, there's just been also a lot of growth on my side since I joined Octavia. And I think one mantra we've been having here is, you know, you have to invest in yourself. Not just, you know, from the time you get into the time you know you're a manager or leadership, you really have to invest in yourself. And because of that form of investment, yeah, you find, you know, there's just this, you know, kind of output. I think we rub off each other, you know, we shadow each other in meetings. They're just trying to, you know, get some nuggets of wisdom here and there. But, you know, I think the one thing which we are super proud of, or something which we do a lot, is we invest in ourselves. And, you know, because we are young, and it's a question I know Matt, you get a lot as well. When you compare ourselves and our peers, how do we set ourselves apart, and how do we ensure, we get the most and we have that form of credibility.
Martin, now I have to turn to you. You used to be a consultant at Dahlberg and you moved to Kenya for this project, but you're also, I mean, you also just graduated recently. Are you even 30? How old are you? That's not a very nice question to ask. You're 29. Amazing. Well, okay. So tell us a little bit about your life before you decided to uproot it and move to Kenya to build a direct air capture company.
Yeah, totally. I mean, where do you want to start? I am originally from Austria. Grew up in a sort of small post-industrial town, son of a train driver, and yeah, I had an opportunity to spend 2 years of my youth on the African continent, one in South Africa, one in Zambia, and really just like had a like strong appreciation for like, you know, the amazing talent that's around here, and I think how often quite underleveraged it is. And, you know, went from there to the UK for 7 years, first to study in Cambridge and then work in international development at Dahlberg, really on that question of like, how do you maximize human potential? And I think carbon removal came to me as such an interesting way of doing that, because we know that it has to be a large industry. And, you know, like I think we're building it from scratch. And I think especially for technology like direct air capture, there is no better place for it than Kenya. And I think, with that ambition, I kind of moved out here to start this. But yeah, and I think lived in London previously before moving to Kenya about, I think it's now 2.5 years ago, like going up to 3. Yeah, so that was sort of old Martin, and new Martin has very much been like excited about building things in Kenya. It's such a sort of youthful, optimistic place. I always said it. I think you do notice the average age of a country when you stay there. Like, and I think you notice if like the average person in that country is like, you know, 40, like it would be the case in Austria or the UK, or if they're like 18, and which is the case in Kenya. And you notice that as a big difference to just like the vibe of a place, if you like. And I think I've always quite enjoyed that sort of youthful energy that Kenya brings.
And you have a family, you moved your wife, you have a child.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think like as sort of
she had to get on board with it too. What was her, how did she feel? Did she look at you like, you want to do what?
So here's the funny thing. Like, she's German, but we actually met in Tanzania. So we met, funny enough, in Zanzibar. And like in a local like Tanzanian restaurant. And, you know, that was more than 10 years ago now, as it happens. I think always had the ambition of moving back to the region. You know, if anything, like she was way better prepared than me, because she's actually fluent in Swahili, like proper Swahili, like they speak in Tanzania, not the one they speak in Kenya. The Kenyans. I think she's a midwife, so she was always quite passionate about like, you know, applying her skills in sort of like, you know, development settings as well. I think it was just quite a good fit for us. And I think initially we were thinking that, you know, like we wanted to sort of move abroad a bit before like settling down and having kids. Octavia came about, and I think I realized that we both realized that we really love Kenya.
How did direct air capture come into your life though, Martin? What was that seed?
So I think I've seen the same stock image that everyone else has seen from like the Climeworks Tinville plant in an Economist article in, it must have been 2019 or so, which is also like FYI, like why it was such a nice, it went full circle last year in June when the Economist actually wrote about our project specifically as well. Very tough.
What a moment.
I think that's just like how that came to me. And I guess, you know, I've always been a sort of techno-optimist. And I think, you know, over the long term, I like to think that being techno-optimist is being techno-realist in many ways, though, like get some caveats there. I think, again, I mean, DAC maybe inherently appeals to people who are optimistic about what technology can achieve. But I think... rightly so, and I think it has definitely shown amazing advances even over the past decade or so, very much pushed by the likes of Climeworks and, you know, Carbon Engineering, Global Thermostat. Folks have done this for a long time. And, you know, like, frankly, everyone who's now sort of like building that data capture company stands in their debt. They have done amazing work just really creating this space. And I think we're inspired by their work, and I think want to sort of like take it to the next level by, like, you know, like spreading it, like, you know, geographically, like technologically, like trying new things, tying in, like, you know, new resources and then better locations. And yeah, I think ultimately working together towards restoring the atmosphere. So I think that data capture is something that really appealed to me, is something that, you know, can, you know, both fix climate change, but then if we can build it at Kenyan scale, also really help, frankly, make Kenya a high-income country. And I think there's no reason why it can't be. The industry is large enough that could happen, and we want to make it happen. And so I think it's always been a quite empowering combination of fixing the climate and also, you know, like helping Kenya grow.
What was your very first step, though? What was the first thing you did? You saw that, it grabbed you. You were like, this is what I want to go into.
Like, I think I kind of had the name before I actually knew it was their data capture. So like, I heard about Octavia Butler on a podcast somewhere, and I was like, Octavia, that's a really good name for a company. And I think then eventually, like, I mean, that was kind of clear that we wanted to do like data capture. Funny enough, like, I mean, you always imagine it's so much easier when you start out. I was thinking we would be a DAG project developer, and that there would be like DAG machines from around the world that we could just bring to Kenya and have people deploy here. We tried that for a few months and then realized that there is no DAG machines on Earth. Basically, if you want DAG machines, you have to build them, which means that you also have to like develop the technology from scratch. And we ended up doing it, like, you know, against the odds. I think we now have like pretty excellent and very competitive data capture machines, and are proud to push that technology in Kenya. So yeah, that's kind of how that went. So I think the very first thing, like, I wonder if there's like a sort of picture book moment that sort of happened there, but maybe not so much. I think it just like sort of started. It started dawning on me, and I think we were sort of at some point, I think, in a Dahlberg project, sort of mapping carbon removal opportunities across the African continent, mostly focusing on nature-based solutions. But I sort of like, you know, took a bit of a detour to look at a case of where in the continent do you have the best geothermal, the best geology, the best solar, the best wind. And like the overlap of all these was just Kenya. And it was just so clear. And like I did more searching on that and looked at the case, but like, what about Indonesia? What about the Philippines? Oh, they have lots of coal. And then what I realized is like, the more I looked into this, it's just like, shit, Kenya really is by far the best place to build DAC. And I think the more like the more research you do on it, and like I went deep into that rabbit hole, and that rabbit hole has since become my life's work. And you realize that there really is no place like Kenya to massively scale this technology. And I think, yeah, like essentially that's what led me to this place, you know, being in a company of 58 with 57 Kenyans really building this out of scale.
It's a very great thing to become possessed by something. And I think this is one of the great benefits actually of consulting jobs, which are so grindy and not often the most fun, but you do learn a lot, and it forces you to kind of get exposed to a bunch of different things and study them. And then you can kind of have that lightning bolt moment.
Yeah, and I'll set up for Dahlberg there. Like, I always loved working there. It's a fantastic place where you can do consulting, but like exclusively focused on international development and impact. And I think that was always just something that was a really great and productive environment for, you know, like ideas like this to emerge in Bubble 34. And I think, yeah, I mean, there's like the fun thing is there's like now a bit of an ecosystem around their data capture in Kenya. Mm-hmm. Folks like James Mwangi, who some of you have heard of, like Bill Ndirangu of Great Carbon Valley. The dirty secret is that all of these are former Dahlberg people. So like good ideas like spread quickly in some of these organizations. And I think that's something we definitely notice with back in Kenya.
Very cool. Well, it's so great to talk with you. It's very inspiring. I'm really honored to know you and have some time. And I guess that's it. Martin, your song list also before I get anything up. So we know.
I cannot
know
tell you how often I've sung The Wheels on the Bus Go Round and Round to myself.
You're listening to that.
I
will make a playlist with Wheels on the Bus. I'll do it.
Yeah, no, it's somewhere between that. And I think like I've got this weird fascination with sort of like, you know, mashups and techno remixes of popular songs. It's sort of a very specific thing, but I kind of listen to that on endless repeat while I work or really do anything. And I don't know, like weirdly it helps me focus. And I think that this is like this specific art of techno, like transitioning one song to another, which I always admired. I don't know what it is, but if you had to ask me, that's some passion I have when it isn't Wheels on the Bus Go Round and Round. And I hope that nobody will take this as inspiration to mash up the Wheels on the Bus Go Round and Round with some other techno.
Well, thank you both very, very much. I look forward to tracking the progress of Octavia Carbon.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Christina.
Thank you.
You know, what the work you're doing at Tomorrow's Air is super cool. Again, I think we want, you know, people to travel and experience the richness of the world's landscapes and so on, and to protect those at the same time, appreciate their preciousness and protect it. And I think that's something that we hugely appreciate at Tomorrow's Air, because you really have as your mission to do both of these. And we hope that you know, in that evangelizing, you'll inspire more people to come by Kenya and appreciate the massive diversity of landscapes and beauty that we have, and hopefully sprinkle in a bit of therapeutic capture and storage on their trips as well, to get inspired by, you know, how it all fits together and how Kenya is a model for the world in being a truly sustainable society.
We're going to do it.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks, guys.